Welcome to Between Two Chairs, Demystifying Commercial Real Estate, the podcast that brings you the latest insights and trends on the South Florida commercial real estate market with your hosts, Fernando Arencibia Jr. and Jennifer Wollman. In each episode, we dive into the world of commercial real estate and break down complex concepts to make them accessible for everyone. Whether you're a real estate professional, a curious investor, or just interested in the South Florida market in general, Between Two Chairs is the podcast for you. So pull up a chair and join us.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Between Two Chairs. My name is Fernando Arencibia, and with me, as always, is the ever studious Jennifer Wollman. Jennifer, say hi.
Hello, everybody. I thought you were going to say angelic after a little conversation. You can use that for the next one.
I'll do that for the next one. Absolutely. Well, we have a very special guest and a very special episode. I love it when we do a deep dive on something that is very specific, and it is an incredible investment tool that is at the disposal of all investors in the country. So, Jennifer, would you kindly introduce our guest?
Of course. Today, we are interviewing Diane Rivera with Craft 1031 Solutions. And in case the name didn't give it away, we're going to be talking about the 1031 tax-deferred exchanges. And for those listeners who are new to real estate, one of the many benefits of investing in real estate is the ability to build wealth using other people's money and getting tax breaks or deferring taxes. So 1031 tax deferred exchanges allow you to keep 100% of your equity working for you instead of paying out about one third of your profits and equity to taxes. So Diane Rivera, we've talked before about people that you need to have in your toolbox and on your team if you're working in anything to do with the real estate industry. And Diane Rivera is one of those people who should be on your team's list, because even if you're not doing 1031s or your clients aren't yet, I can guarantee with time that you spend in the business, the question is going to come up, and she's just an amazing resource. She'll be one of your investors' best friends as she helps them save money and rapidly compound their wealth. So Diane, welcome, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here with you. Even though we're far apart, but we look close together.
Yes, yes. Give us some background. Where are you from?
Okay. Well, I'm from the West Coast, way West Coast, being California. I've worked in the 1031 industry for about the last 29, 30 years. Started out with one of the original 1031 companies out of California. And later in the 2000s, early 2000s, moved to South Dade. So here I am in Miami and started out educating people, you know, meeting and talking with CPAs, talking with investors and realtors, attorneys about the benefits of the 1031 exchange. So I provide trainings for offices, like real estate offices, associations, continuing education in 1031 exchanges. And then the biggest part of my job is consultation. We do provide all of the 1031 qualified intermediary services, but upfront and from the beginning, it's providing education again and making sure.
Yeah, that's how we met 20-something years ago.
Exactly. In one of those classes. So my first conversations with investors is going to be, what do you own? How long have you owned it? How do you use it? And so on and so forth, to make sure that, you know, the properties they're looking at selling qualify for the 1031. And there are lots of little intricacies within it that it may seem to a lot of people like it's very straightforward. Oh, there's three rules that you have to follow, but there's a lot in between that needs to be addressed or could be issues.
I want to get into some of those challenges and the oopses and what to look out for down the road. But can you give us a brief basic 1031 overview? You mentioned three rules, which Fernando and I love the number three. So can you give us just kind of a brief overview and breakdown of
the steps? Absolutely. I'm happy to. So the first thing we look at is, the property that you're selling, which is going to be what qualifies for the 1031 exchange to begin with. We look at whether it's considered like-kind. And people have a misconception because that sounds like, oh, if I sell a rental house, I have to buy a rental house. But like-kind does not mean that. It's qualifying property that has been held for investment or production of income in a trade or business. So it could be raw land, it could be multifamily, it could be commercial, any of those types of real estate, as long as you don't live in it. If you use it for your personal use, like a second home or a primary residence, it doesn't qualify for a 1031 exchange. So that's the first rule, is making sure what you're selling and also what you're thinking of purchasing qualifies for 1031.
Real quick, you mentioned something that I want us to come back to. You said if it's a second home that you use for personal use, it doesn't qualify. But there is a way to make it qualify, right? Where you stop using it for personal use and you turn it into a rental.
Yes, you would be converting the qualified use of the property. And the IRS does have some procedures, revenue procedures that address that. It happens over a period of time. And that conversion basically can happen with a primary residence or second home. You stop using it over the next two 12-month periods or 24 months. You have to rent it out a certain amount of time and you have to minimize your use. I don't want to get into all the very tiny details of it, but it can be converted so that it will qualify under the IRS 1031 guidelines. And also with your primary residence, for instance, a lot of people will invest, they'll do their 1031 exchange and buy a property, a rental property on the beach or in the mountains or in some place that area that they like. And after having rented it out for a few years, that 24 months or more, which I would suggest the or more, they decide to stop renting it at that time and they end up moving into it. Nothing happens tax-wise at that moment as far as any tax liability being due. But if you decide to sell it within a short time period after that, things have changed. It's no longer an investment property. You now live in it. It's a primary. Now you have to qualify for the other primary residence exclusion. There's some fluctuation there between how much of percentage of both the primary residence and the tax deferred, you know, portion of it, the investment portion, because there's a look back period of 5 years. So it gets a little more complicated to just say it in general, how it works. You have to look at the situation, but the IRS has that 24 month rule, a minimum of 14 days that it has to be rented out in each of those two 12 month periods. And a maximum of 14 days that the owner could stay in it, or up to 10% of the time it's rented in that 12-month period. So it gets a little complicated. So you have to look at
this. We don't have to go into more details. I just wanted to have you give us an example of how you can change a use to take advantage of the different tax laws, because real estate for our listeners, and we've said it before, is a long game. But when you exit, you really need to plan to maximize the benefits of real estate. You really need to plan how you plan on not only using the property itself that you're going to buy after, but also what you need to do to maximize the tax benefits of owning real estate. So thank you so much for doing that dive.
Yes. So as far as the rules, you know, the basic rules for completing a 1031 exchange, again, we look at that the property has to qualify. So it's been an investment property that's been owned for a period of time, ideally more than a year. You know, everybody's situation is different. But as long as that's the case, then we know the property should qualify for the 1031. The exchange doesn't start until the closing on the sale of the relinquished property, is what we refer to that as. By that time, we, as the qualified intermediary, have already produced the exchange documents and instructions that have to be part of the closing. and the taxpayer, our seller, has to have signed the documents, and we have to have the exchange account set up so that their money flows directly from the closing into the exchange account. So from that closing date, they have 45 days to identify in writing what they intend to purchase, okay? And a total of 180 days to complete the exchange. So that 45-day deadline, that's probably the trickiest part of the whole exchange. Because if they don't have their property by then, if they cannot provide us with a list, which is what the IRS says, give a written list unambiguously of the addresses of the properties that you intend to purchase. They have two rules. The first one being that you can identify up to three properties for any total value. The second one is that you could choose to identify more than three properties, but when you add up all those properties, it cannot be more than 200% of the value of what you sold. So if it was 500,000, then a million is your 200%. So if you list four properties or five properties, you can't hit 2 million in total value, or you're expected to buy all of them. The 95% rule pops up, which says, okay, you can identify over 2 million, but you better be sure you can receive ownership and close on all of them, because you have to get 95% of that value. So most people use the three property rule unless they're selling for a very high value. Say they're selling for $10 million and they're going to buy, you know, $1 million, $2 million, you know, up in that price range or even less, they're going to be able to list a lot because $20 million is their 200%. So that's the identification rules. And again, the 45-day deadline is really the place. If an exchange is going to fail, it fails there, because the person has not gotten anything under contract. They may list their three properties, but they can't change that list after they passed the 45th day. So if they can't buy them, they're out of luck. Okay. So in the last rule is really what we want to accomplish, which is balancing the exchange, meaning that they have purchased enough property that all of their proceeds have been spent, and they replaced any mortgage payoff that they have paid off in the sale. So they're in effect purchasing property of equal or greater value to what they sold. That's balancing their exchange.
So Diane, let me ask you a question that came to mind. So if, you know, as you know, there are a lot of properties that are owned by multiple owners, and maybe not all of them wish to do a 1031 exchange. So in looking at those rules, I'm wondering, if you have three owners in a property and they decide to sell and the sales price is, let's say, you know, they're going to sell for $900,000. One of the three parties decides that they want to do a 1031 exchange. When you're looking at that 200% rule, for example, and of identifying this property, would they look at 200% of the 900 or 200% of the 300,000 that would be his third, you know, share of the property?
Well, it really depends how they own the property together. Are they tenants in common, where there's three individuals that went on title, or say three LLCs or a mix of that? Or is it one entity? And what those three people own are membership units or shares in an entity, which is not real estate. So in that scenario, the first way that it would be looked at is that it's the entity, 123 Main Street LLC, that is the one that's supposed to be doing the 1031 exchange. If there are tenants in common, each person could decide what they want to do. And if they own a one-third interest in the real estate, then they can take their $300,000, and that is their target of their, you know, equal or greater in value. So the 200% rule would be $600,000 for that person. But there's many scenarios like that where people are members or shareholders in an entity, partners, and they don't all want to do the same thing now that the property is being sold. So there are methods to, depending on, you know, who wants to do the exchange? Is it the other two people that want to keep the entity? Is it the one single person, you know, that wants to drop out and do an exchange? They have a couple of methods that are referred to as a drop and swap, or a drop or swap and drop. It's person coming out of that entity and then doing an exchange, or the other way around. It can be considered aggressive. We would definitely want them talking to their own tax advisor while doing this, or tax attorney. But we can explain that process, you know, if that scenario comes up. But this isn't the forum to really go into all those details.
No, but that's super interesting because, again, going back to real estate and how many people are getting into it. So if you think this is a way that you're going to want to build wealth, is through taking advantage of all these tax breaks and 1031 exchanges and deferrals, is how you buy and how you set up your company. The way that you purchase real estate is super important, because a lot of people, like right now, there are a lot of syndications, right? We've seen syndications flourish over the last several years. So more and more people are getting into real estate. But depending on how the syndication, based on what you just said, I believe, how that syndication is set up will depend on whether or not an individual within that syndication can do a 1031. So again, in terms of longer term planning, I think talking to Diane, as well as your CPA, as well as an attorney, because their liability issues are different if you own it as tenants in common versus if you own shares in an entity that owns the property. So again, Diane, Tool Belt Real Estate team for you and your clients, whether you're the investor or your customers are moving forward. So right. Thank you for clarifying.
Sure. Sure. So with the 1031, the purpose is to defer, you know, what we're talking about is deferring capital gains taxes. That's an area that I find with customers that call into me and they tell me, oh, I only have this much in gain, so I'm not sure if the 1031 is worth it. Most of the times when somebody says that to me, I know what they're telling me. They're telling me how much equity they think they're going to net on the sale. And they think that's the gain, and it is not. So you have to know, first of all, what is your tax liability and how do you figure that out? So it has nothing to do with your equity and your debt on the property. The person would need to think about how much they originally paid for the property, how many years they've owned it because they've been depreciating the property, and that tells them what their basis in the property is. That's the accounting side of owning real estate. Writing off depreciation every year, which is a tax benefit, and you don't want to leave it on the table because it lowers your regular income tax bill, but it also lowers the basis, the cost basis in the investment property that you own. So when the property is being sold, you look at what is that adjusted basis and what is the net selling price after commissions are taken off and other non-recurring closing costs. That is the gain. So it doesn't matter how much debt they're paying off on the property and what their proceeds are that are left over. Those are the numbers they're going to use when they're buying property. I have this much cash and I have to replace this much debt. Okay. But the tax liability is calculated on the gain in the property, which is the value above what has been depreciated. Did I explain that well?
Yeah, so basically you have to take into account the depreciation recapture. So somebody who has owned it for 10 years versus somebody who's owned it for 2 years is going to have very different expectations of what that number is going to be.
Right. So, you know, that's where they have to be aware of, not how much cash. So starting there, you know, each section, there's different parts of capital gains tax. Your appreciation, which is, you know, what you've gained over the years of ownership, gets taxed at 20%. The depreciation recapture tax is 25%. So how much in depreciation you've taken is taxed at a different rate. It's taxed at the 25%. Plus, if they're selling an estate with state taxes, they're going to pay that state's tax. And there may also be the 3.8 healthcare tax, which is like Obamacare. It's based on investment income. So you hit a certain threshold and you may have that tax.
And all of those get deferred with the 1031 exchange.
Yes. Now, some states, it's changed over the years, but some states that are trying to capture that income before a person leaves the state will say that if you buy within the state, we defer it. We go along with the federal, because 1031 is federal tax law. They'll go along with that. Some states, and I don't recall which ones they are now, but they will say, well, if you're leaving the state, if you're not buying here, well, thank you very much, but we'll collect our tax now. So we don't lose, you know, track of that when you sell someday. But pretty much everything generally, you know, we're dealing with Florida sales for the most part, will be all, you know, totally deferred. That means, too, that it's going into the next property.
Right.
Right, right. One of the challenges, obviously, as you mentioned, is identifying a property within 45 days. You and I had this, well, I had this problem when I was trying to do a 1031 selling a property at the height of the market, and I just couldn't find a deal where the numbers made sense within the 45 days. So even though I had everything set up, I ended up not doing an exchange. And we're seeing a lot of people running into that, because let's be clear, 1031 exchanges are not always in your best interest, even if you are deferring it. If it means you having to rush into a bad deal, just pay your taxes. But what are some options? I know we talked briefly about reverse exchanges. Tell us a little bit about that, and when are the best times to use a reverse exchange?
Yeah, reverse exchanges are a great option. They do cost more, so it has to make sense that there's, you know, you're deferring so much in gain, it makes sense to do this more complex and costly type of a 1031 exchange. But if a person knows that, you know, what they're looking for is difficult to find, and if they sell, they may have, you know, that timing difficulty to locate what they want to buy in that 45-day period, they could hold off on selling. If they know that their sale will be attractive and that people, you know, that it's not going to be that hard to sell, and they could decide to purchase first. So a reverse exchange is still a 1031 tax deferral from the sale into the purchase, but we're buying a property before we've closed on the sale. We still have to balance the exchange. So we want to know, what are we selling? You know, what will it sell for approximately? How much equity proceeds do you expect to come out of it? And what are you buying? Are you buying something that will be enough to cover that? It doesn't have to, because you can also finish that sale off with a delayed exchange if there's excess proceeds there. But we would go into purchasing the new property first. Generally, it works the easiest where that taxpayer we're working for has the money, has the cash to buy the property all cash. We're not dealing with a lender, because the intermediary has to also act as an accommodation title holder. So we put on a different cap, and when we go to that closing, different instructions, you're going to deed that property to us. We are going to set up a single member LLC where the intermediary is the single member. This is to make it easier at the end of this whole process to just transfer the LLC to our customer. But we take title to the property at the closing. They're loaning us the money, so they're going to have a note and a mortgage that they put this cash into the property. And now we're waiting for them to sell. They also have a master lease. They run the property, they manage it, they clean it up, they rent it, you know, they do improvements if they need to while we're waiting for the sale. When the sale happens, we're going to take that cash. We're going to come back over here to the replacement property, and we're going to pay off our note and transfer the LLC to the customer. That's how they receive they've relinquished now because they sold, and now they're receiving their replacement prop. It can also be done if there's sometimes a lender, we can meet eye to eye on, you know, the non-recourse to us that we have to have, and the client could be the guarantor on the mortgage. then we can do a reverse with a lender on that side, or it could be seller financing, or we could take title to the property that's being sold instead.
Is there a time frame from when you have to close on the property that you're selling for the 1031 to work?
There is.
For the reverse to
it's
work?
It's still a 1031 exchange in reverse. So from the date that we close on that purchase, they have 45 days to identify what it is they're selling. So most of the time they know what it is that they're selling. But sometimes I have had customers where they have three or four properties on the market and they're like, whichever one sells first. So by the 45th day, they're going to have to narrow that down to one of them. But that's not that we see multiple ones on them.
And then they have 180 days to close
180
on their
days. To close on the sale and for us to transfer the new property to them.
So let's say it's the 180th day, you can still do the closing because you are the closing agent. So the closing can, I mean, the intermediary holding the funds and the property.
So we just have to make sure that they've, you know, set up this closing well before the 180th day, because anything can happen. If it gets ticked over to day 181, they've lost the exchange. So there's no extensions except for, you know, presidentially declared disasters, which we don't want.
So tell us, you talked at the beginning briefly about some of the issues that can come up. Tell us some of the mistakes that you've seen happen when people try to do a 1031 and how can those be avoided?
In general, like anything, it's paying attention, asking questions, making sure what the timing is. Some people just assume that, oh, I'll get an extension because, you know, on the timing deadlines, because you can get an extension to file your tax returns. But 1031 doesn't have any extensions. So the biggest mistake that I see people make is that once they have a good solid buyer on their property, and even though they haven't closed, they should be looking for property to purchase. You know, they should already, if they're not ready to make an offer, fine, but they should be looking at the market and seeing what's there, and maybe they can get a contingent offer accepted. Now they're ahead of the 45-day deadline. Most of it has to do with that 45 days, because if they're looking at properties and then they decide that everything, the most important thing is to file this form, giving us the three properties, and they send it to us on day 20. And I'm like, please don't send it to us yet. We don't even want to see it. Put day 40 on your calendar so that the bells and whistles go off then, and then you fill out the form. Because if you have to change the form, you've got to rescind it. You've got to rewrite it. You've got to resubmit it. And that can get forgotten because they already sent it in. They think they're covered and they forget about it. Another thing is that whenever you're contemplating that you may be doing a 1031, don't start quit claiming properties. A lot of people will say, you know, on the property they're selling, well, really, it should be so-and-so and myself on the property and not just me. Or, yes, I've been taking care of it for my mother all these years. It's my property because I know I'm going to inherit it, but it's still in mom's name. So it's mom's property, right? Things like that need to be discussed before people quit claim properties. There's so many other little things, but really it's calling and asking questions, even if they're not listed yet. I take all calls. So anytime somebody has a question on 1031, they're welcome to call me. And that way they know going forward, they're taking the right steps.
Yeah. And this is a really important component. There's something that you mentioned earlier, which I think it's very smart. And I have spoken to investors that have like a rule of thumb, right? They say, well, if I'm going to sell a property and the equity is X amount, then it's not worth it for me to do a 1031 exchange, or above this threshold, then it is worth it. You know, based on what you said earlier about the appreciation recapture and all the other items, I think it behooves any investor to have those conversations in advance. What I also appreciate about, as we discuss, having this group of partners in your business is that I've had transactions where things got a little bit sticky because the person wanted to do a 1031 exchange. The buyer have flexibility on timeline, right? And the seller was just concerned that, well, I'm not going to find what I'm looking for, right? And so what was written into the contract was, okay, so we're going to go through this contract. I'm going to go through due diligence, but it'll be a point in which the money goes hard. It's a cash purchase. And then I can give you an extended closing to help you identify the property so that you don't feel like I'm stuck with that 45 days. Right. So before I close on my transaction, I'm going to wait for you to identify the property seller so that you are confident and comfortable knowing, all right, now I have a place to put the money and then to go through that process. And so they have the conversations with the 1031 exchanger. They get all their ducks in a row, and then you can actually utilize it as a tool to actually get the transaction going. Right. Because it's the only way that the seller wants to sell. And especially when you have a buyer that has that layer of flexibility as well.
Yeah, coordinating with one another, because it, you know, really is a juggling act to deal with these timing deadlines and having that over your head that you can't extend it. I mean, I've seen plenty of exchanges and exchangers fail in their exchanges because they couldn't do anything about it. So if they look at that up front, you know, and they have extensions, you know, the ability to ask for an extension already discussed or somehow in the contract, then it's just easier for them.
Let me clarify that, because you had mentioned the 45 days and identifying the property. So in the scenario that Fernando just painted, let's say I'm the seller and I've maybe identified two properties or one property, but I don't feel sure. It has to be 45 days before my closing, correct? So the extension has to be, because if I've already, let's say I've identified the properties already and I've hit day 40 and I give them to you and something happens and those properties sell, right? And his buyer can give me an extension, but it doesn't matter because I've already started with you? Or can that process be stopped and restarted?
Can't be stopped and restarted because it's based on the sale closing date.
Right, but closing date, right? Because he has the flexible buyer that says, look, I'm willing to work with you. I really want this property, because if not, the seller's not going to sell to me.
Right. So in that case, the buyer says, well, we were going to close next Friday, but you are still trying to do some inspections or whatever on the new property, and you won't have answers until like next Friday. And the buyer says, that's okay. I really want this property. We don't have to close this Friday. I'll give you another week. You know, I mean, there's that whole negotiation in between, because the buyer has his vested interest too, not to get stuck extending and extending. Your 1031 timeframe is not even going to start until the closing. You close.
Okay, I just wanted to clarify that it's not from the time he identifies the properties.
No, because there's no need to send us anything until close to the 45th day after the sale has closed.
Okay, I just wanted to be
clear
on that.
So it doesn't start from signing the contract. But it all depends on the type of property, right? Because we know if it's a commercial property, they may need 4 months for all environmental and 40-year and all this other stuff, right? So they could need more days, you know. So depending on their closing date, coordinating with their buyer could become useful. So
is there an issue if you have, in that scenario where you have an extended closing, if a seller puts a property under contract prior to the closing of their property without doing a reverse exchange, and the closing happens on next day, and then the next day they tell you, look, I've already identified a property, I already put it under contract, here's the paperwork, and let's get the work started. Does the order of things matter? The date of the contract for the property that the seller is buying, does that matter for doing the 1031 exchange?
It does not. He can be in contract on the purchase months before he sells. Doesn't matter.
So the only defining date is the closing date.
Yeah, he can't close on it without without having us involved already.
Yeah, and that's also why, and I'll mention this because we have a lot of brokers that listen to the podcast. There's usually language that you want to add to the contract that basically, if you are a buyer that is doing a 1031 exchange, you want the seller to cooperate with all the paperwork, just because remember that the transferring of title doesn't really go to you. It goes to the intermediary. And so, you know, you want to have that cooperation because there are going to be some documents that the other party has to sign. And so there's usually some language that you want to have in the contract just to make sure that everybody is aware and that they are agreeing to cooperate with, you know, with all the paperwork, basically.
Two things that are important there on the purchase side, but both documents, the selling contract and the purchasing contract, should have the 1031 clause, which the IRS states needs to ask for the cooperation of the other party and to let them know of your intent to be doing a 1031 exchange. So it generally will say, you know, if buyer or seller intends to do a 1031 exchange, the other party, the seller or buyer, will cooperate at no cost or liability to that party. And the other thing is that especially in the, well, both contracts, but especially where the exchanger is purchasing, that contract needs to be assignable because that's what that cooperation is dealing with. The contract gets assigned with the documents that we provide. There's an assignment of the contract included, and there's a notice to the other party that the contract is being signed. The taxpayer is signing the assignment over to us as qualified intermediary. The other party has to acknowledge that, okay, I'm aware this is happening and that's okay with me. So you don't want that clause, that box checked, that says that this contract cannot be assigned. You want the box checked that says, you know, contract may be assigned, but whomever is not relieved of their, you know, duties and responsibilities under the contract.
Now, Diane, let me ask you, because, you know, anybody who's listening to the episode is going to realize that there are intricacies to 1031 exchanges. It's not as straightforward as people think. And I believe that just based on the conversation, people have a lot of misconceptions about what it is and what it isn't and what you're able to do. And I think it's very wise to have that conversation with an advisor such as yourself. One of the things, as you can imagine, we get a lot of questions about 1031 exchanges in our business. And one of the things that I always mention is, look, you want to speak to an expert that does this day in and day out and that knows it like the back of their hand, which is why we always refer you. But also laws, you don't know what happens in a period of time. I had somebody, well, I did a 1031 exchange 10 years ago. Well, how do you know that any of the laws that were applicable 10 years ago have not evolved or changed or transitioned, and now there's a different way of doing it? And that's why you want to speak to an expert. Do you see a lot of changes in the way that 1031s have implemented? I know with the Tax Jobs and Cuts Act, there was some conversation about it being only real property, not personal property, and things of that nature.
Personal property.
Yeah.
Yeah, it took away the ability for businesses to say they were selling their real estate, their building, and selling the business. Well, equipment, fixtures and equipment, and things like that, computers and all of that, that would be in a sale, could be exchanged, personal property for personal property of like kind and the same value. That went away completely. No personal property can be exchanged whatsoever. And the tax code for 1031 has not changed much in practically since the 70s. But then even before that, when it started, the ability to swap properties, which was back in like the 19-teens, you know, 1910, 1915, there was swapping back then. So they codified a lot of the rules that came out of some tax court cases in the 70s. That's what we live by today. The 45 and 180-day deadlines, the descriptions, you know, of like-kind property, how you identify. A lot of that, it came out of those court cases because it was just court cases before. Since then, in 2008, they came up with the rules that we were talking about earlier, which had to do with the timing on personal use of investment properties and converting the qualified use, which is what the IRS refers to how you use it, investment or income producing. That's when those revenue procedures came out. And there's, you know, very minute different things that don't come out in the tax code, but are tax court cases, you know, but we don't get to that level. I mean, and if it's going to be something really, really odd within and complicated within a person's transaction, you can believe that we're going to know that there's something there that we need to have them talk to their tax attorney, because we're not CPAs or attorneys. We don't give tax or legal advice. We're specialists in 1031 exchanges, having been doing them for 30 years. But if there's something particular, that's where we have them bring in their own tax advisor. But for the most part, most people can guarantee if they did a 1031 10 years ago, it's not going to be any different today. They can sign their documents electronically.
And I just want to point out that there's no limit as to how many 1031 exchanges you can do.
No, as many properties as you have. And the one thing is that you can't flip. You know, you can't be, if you got a lot of properties or you're thinking, I'm just going to buy this property, fix it up and sell it. That does not qualify for 1031. The IRS looks at that as an action that is used, that is done for ordinary income generation. It's like your job. So it's not really a long-term investment. You know, so most everything is the same over the last 30 years. So they just need to, if they're thinking about doing a 1031, just to call a specialist, you know, so that they can say, this is the property I'm thinking of selling. Oh, and we know the questions to ask them. Who's on title? How long has it been owned? What is your plan going forward? You know, because just those simple conversations, they may come up and tell us something that they're thinking they're going to do. Oh, I'm buying my brother's property. Nope, sorry, you can't buy your relative's property. That's a rule that, you know, no related parties. You know, there might be a very, you know, there is a very succinct way that they can do that, but it's more than likely it's not going to be done in that way. So if they tell me they're buying from a relative, then that's something to find out well in advance so that they don't go along thinking the whole time, yeah, I'm buying that property. And then they sell, they set up their exchange, or the other way around, they set up their exchange and then they sell. And then they find out that that property won't qualify.
Are there any instances where a foreign buyer or owner can do a 1031 if they're paying taxes in the States?
Absolutely. That's kind of two different types of seller, foreign sellers that you mentioned. You can have a foreign seller, but that created a U.S. entity that's not just a disregarded entity and elected to be treated as a U.S. taxpayer. Then they can do an exchange like anybody else because it's the entity that is the U.S. taxpayer. However, if it's a foreign person or foreign entity doing an exchange or wants to do an exchange that they own the property in a disregarded entity, like a single member LLC, remember, that's disregarded. So what is seen is the foreign person selling a property. They're subject to FRPTA. Now, they can still do a 1031 exchange. It's a little more complicated. And just to put it in simple terms, what that process would mean is they've got to have a CPA involved before they close on that sale to help them file with the FRPTA unit. And they have to have ideally, the ability to offset whatever that withholding is going to be with their own cash temporarily, and then they can do the exchange. But my experience is most of the time when it comes up to explaining what has to be done and that they're going to have to come out of pocket, it can be a lot because it's 15% of the sales price, right? So if it's $150,000 and they say, well, you know, I don't have that sitting around that I can just pull it. It's in investments, it's in stock, it's not in cash. then it may be too difficult for them to do.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. I mean, being in Florida in general and Miami, particularly, you know, I don't know if a lot of our foreign investors are aware that some of these exchanges and deferrals are available to them if depending on how they purchase their properties.
Right. And it depends, you know, I mean, I like to keep kind of in my pocket the people that I, you know, say, well, you need to go speak to so-and-so, you know, this CPA or tax attorney, you know, specializes in foreign investors, you know, so that they will know what this process is, because you don't want to just try to educate their accountant to do this, because it gets complicated.
I can imagine. Great. Well, do you have any more questions for Diane?
No, this has been very instructive. Really appreciate you coming along to this episode and giving the explanation. You know, we always use you as a reference point and refer any questions to you for, I think it's obvious for anybody listening to the episode why Diane is so good at what she does.
Certified exchange specialist. 30 years. Yeah. So anybody's welcome to call me. You can provide them my contact information. And
yeah, we'll have that in show notes. Absolutely. For sure. Thank you so much for your time, Diane. And thank you to
so
everybody
welcome.
For
thank
listening.
You. This has been fun. Thanks. Take care.